Welcome to the American Cafe. I'm your host, Ira Melman. Here in the United States, it seems just about everyone is taking photographs of themselves these days.
Like this past weekend, I just got this nose ring, and so I was really excited about it. So I sent everyone a picture of me and my new nose ring.
Deborah Block has the story of the selfie. Bernard Justman is back in the cafe talking about the future of the electric car.
We think that hydrogen is the future of electric vehicles because they're so much more convenient.
Mike O'Sullivan pays us a visit with a story of people from around the world coming to California to learn how to make films.
They want to come and make television and film in the heart of television and film land, and that is Los Angeles.
All of that and more on this week's American Cafe. There is a saying that a picture is worth a thousand words. That may be especially true these days with a huge amount of what are called selfies on the internet. VOA's Deborah Block looks at this popular trend of taking a picture of yourself.
The Pope's doing it. President Obama's doing it. And celebrities like singer Justin Bieber are doing it all the time. Selfies.
I think a lot of people link it to their identity, that a selfie is capturing something that they can show to the world that represents themselves.
Nathaniel Herr, a psychology professor at American University in Washington, explains why the younger generation, in particular, is taking and posting selfies.
They're more comfortable with seeing themselves and thinking about themselves than previous generations were.
College student Caitlin Lehman says they're just another way her generation communicates.
Like today, I was really pissed about being here at school because it's Monday. So I sent a Snapchat to my friend, and he responded with a similar face that he also did not like Mondays.
Another student, Alyssa Jones, compares them to a conversation that has stopped in time.
Well, there's like the, it's been a really long day, so you do like the stare. And then there's like the really like, I'm excited, like.
Lehman says it's important to her that she can control the images and decide when and where to post them.
Like this past weekend, I just got this nose ring, and so I was really excited about it. So I sent everyone a picture of me and my new nose ring.
Some people think selfies are simply narcissistic. A YouTube video by the Chainsmokers makes fun of them.
But first, let me take a selfie.
But Lehman looks at the selfie another way.
It could be a form of art. You know, Van Gogh painted pictures of himself, and so did Rembrandt.
A recent study on selfies shows that young people worldwide express themselves differently. Research at the City University of New York compared selfies in five cities, Moscow, Berlin, New York, Tokyo, and Sao Paulo. Lev Manovich, who headed the project, says the average person is about 24 years old.
The strongest difference we found was in the kind of head turn. So as you head straight or kind of diagonal, look at photos from Moscow, when we girls pose, it's like very much like a fashion magazine, you know? Like we look like models. In Brazil, we're playing with camera. It's much more like a kind of informal.
But there's also a downside to selfies, say both Jones and her.
I would not post anything that I wouldn't want a potential employer to see.
When young people see celebrities posting pictures that emphasize their attractiveness, they may get the message that that's what they should be doing, that they should be emphasizing their own physical qualities over and above all these other qualities that they have. And that can really affect their self-esteem.
Her doesn't see selfies as a trend that will go away, even as the 20-somethings get older.
I think as they get older, you're probably going to see less selfies among that specific generation. But right behind them, there's a younger group of kids waiting to come into that same phase.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
Plug in your car, then unplug and drive away. More and more consumers are doing just that. At the 2014 New York Auto Show, many automakers unveiled electric or hybrid vehicles to address the growing global appetite for environment-friendly cars. While some technological challenges remain, the market is heating up. VOA's Bernard Chessman reports from New York.
This hydrogen fuel cell vehicle from Toyota converts hydrogen into electricity, has a smooth ride, strong acceleration, and leaves no carbon monoxide behind. Toyota's Wade Hoyt.
We think that hydrogen is the future of electric vehicles because they're so much more convenient. And the way it works is the hydrogen wants to combine with the oxygen in the air. It forms H2O, which is water vapor is the only exhaust, so it's a true zero emissions vehicle, and you get electricity out of that combination.
Many manufacturers are now producing hybrids and electric vehicles. Ford has unveiled an all-electric Ford Focus, and Chevy is touting its environment-friendly Volt. While electric cars are easy on the environment, they can also offer strong performance. Tesla's has ferocious acceleration, pushing the car from 0 to about 100 kilometers per hour in 3.7 seconds, with a top speed just over 200 kilometers per hour. Electric motors deliver strong acceleration because they offer more torque than equivalent gasoline engines. That is why luxury brands like BMW are experimenting with this new technology. But the switchover from gasoline is an evolutionary process, says James Bell of General Motors.
I think the mistake a lot of people in the media and the industry maybe thought was that, you know, when the Nissan Leaf came out or the Chevrolet Volt, that suddenly people would drop their gasoline-powered cars and rush for them. No, it's not that way. This is going to be a slow evolution, but it's also a Pandora's box moment. It's not going to get back in. Electrified vehicles are the way to meet those emissions in the future.
Alternative fuel vehicles account for just 1 million of the more than 60 million cars produced worldwide annually. But in 2013, the number of hybrid and electric cars doubled. Automakers still don't make money on electric cars because of the high cost of battery technology. Tesla's battery, for example, costs $50,000, about half of the vehicle's total selling price. But manufacturers pay the costs because they believe electric vehicles are an important part of the industry's future. Matt Miller, auto industry reporter for Bloomberg News, says a mixture of old and new technology is the winning strategy.
Really, the key for the future, I think, is hybrid technology. So rather than having a car like a Tesla that's completely electric power, you have a car like the BMW i3 or i8, which has a small gasoline motor to help charge the battery when it's needed, and electric motors to drive. That's got to be the future. Then you get something like 90 or 100 miles per gallon, which is decent, and you still get the torque when you need it.
The challenge is to produce a car with long, inexpensive battery life that allows the driver to travel a long way between charges. Automakers expect many millions will then decide to switch from gas to alternative fuel. Bernard Chessman at the Auto Show in New York City.
Hollywood, which is part of Los Angeles, is the movie capital of the world, and many aspiring filmmakers go there in hopes of breaking into the movie business. Michael Sullivan reports that regional universities are also a magnet for students who hope to become producers or directors.
Students at California State University, Los Angeles, learn about motion capture, a movie-making technique used in James Cameron's 2009 hit Avatar and other recent movies. Graduate student Ivy Lin from China's Shandong province is putting finishing touches on her student film. It's a tale of cultural differences, romance, and Chinese cooking. She says producing the feature is preparing her for a career.
I hope to do like film producing or marketing in the future, especially like between the U.S. and China.
She raised money on the internet to complete the film and got help from Melinda Pan, a student from Beijing who was doing the final production work on her own student feature. She says China and the United States have many co-productions, including Iron Man 3.
I think sci-fi films probably are the most popular ones because there are so many skills required, and they have big box office in China too. But for me, I like sweet and touching stories.
Pan's film is a story of cultural missteps between a real estate salesman in the United States and a difficult buyer from China. She hopes to work as a producer or director in either country. Film professor Bridget Murnane says the college is teaching new skills for digital media, and that Cal State LA and other Los Angeles universities are attracting international film students.
They want to come and make television and film in the heart of television and film land, and that is Los Angeles.
The international flavor of the campus is part of the attraction for film student Nadine Patel from Gujarat State, India.
With your friends, with your colleagues, your classmates, there is whole sort of, you know, second second level of learning that happens as a human being, that you explore all the cultures. That's what happens in your free time. You know, we are always discussing that, how do you do this, how that happens.
He says this creative interaction will prepare him for a career in the increasingly international movie industry. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
The average American farmer is now 58 years old, and farmers 65 and older are the fastest growing segment of the population. It's a troubling trend signaling big changes ahead for American agriculture as aging farmers retire. Reporter Mike Osborne says a new report from the U.S. Census Bureau is suggesting what some of those changes might look like and why they might not be so troubling.
This is a nice melon. Mmm.
Adrian Gibson works a small plot of land in the rolling hills north of Knoxville, Tennessee. She's something of a novelty in American agriculture, female and a minority. Gibson is succeeding in an industry dominated by white men.
Is it ever ripe at the same time?
Gibson makes a living from her tiny operation by using the Community Supported Agriculture, or CSA, model of farming. She raises food for a handful of contract customers who pay in advance.
We have 23 CSA customers. They subscribe to supporting the farm, and in return, they get a weekly basket of vegetables from May through October.
New data from the U.S. Census Bureau suggests the number of minority farmers working American soil is expanding rapidly. The data also suggests U.S. farms are getting smaller. Nate Phillips, who teaches horticulture at Middle Tennessee State University, says smaller farms are, in part, a reaction to changes in the way Americans think about their food.
This growing interest in where our food's coming from, what is the food quality, things like that. And I think we'll continue to see that increase.
All right, you guys, let me show you how we're going to do these.
Phillips says the interest in where food comes from is also attracting more young people into farming.
I'm seeing a lot more students from Nashville or the cities that are coming in that didn't grow up around agriculture, weren't from an agricultural background, but have that interest.
Just a few years ago, farmer Brandon Witt was one of those young students. His family's 1,000-hectare, heavily mechanized operation dwarfs Adrian Gibson's tiny farm, but he's quickly adapting to the same customer trends. Rather than sell his hogs to commercial packers, he sells them to his neighbors.
And we actually take that one step further here and actually have the meat processed and sell it directly off the farm here through our retail store and to local restaurants and grocery stores.
Witt says consumers need to know not just how their food is produced, but about some of the challenges farmers face putting it on their tables.
That provides us an opportunity to have more direct connection with consumers and getting them out to the farm, teaching consumers about where that food comes from, and quite honestly, just how hard it is to get it there at the end of the day.
Nate Phillips considers it a positive development that the people who grow the food are beginning to look more like the people who consume the food.
It reflects our general society. It reflects, what our communities are like around us, and I think that's a great thing for agriculture.
There's one trend that every American farmer can be pleased about. Census data shows that the value of the food they produce rose more than 25% in just 6 years. Reporting for VOA News, I'm Mike Osborne, down on the farm in Tennessee.
Frank Lloyd Wright, who died in 1959, is known as the father of modern American architecture. Two prehistoric properties in the state of Arizona show the grand expanse of his designs. One is Taliesin West, Wright's rustic winter home and architecture school. Half an hour away is a Wright-influenced hotel that's filled with eye-popping luxury. Shelley Schlender reports from Phoenix.
The buildings at Taliesin West resonate with the surrounding desert through rustic stones, dramatic shadows, and the contrast of water. Wright's groundbreaking design still inspires visitors.
He's uniquely American, and he wanted to break from us just copying.
So I have a niece and a nephew that are both young architects, and I mean, they're all drawn to those that came before.
The Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation reports that it costs over $1 million annually to preserve this National Historic Landmark. Taliesin West is billed as a desert masterpiece. The Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation that oversees the home also supports a school of architecture. The students use the same drafting hall where Wright himself designed New York's Guggenheim Museum. His apprentices, half a century ago, helped build Taliesin West. While preservation efforts are always ongoing, Director of Preservation Fred Prozillo says it's time for a major renovation.
Taliesin West being built in the 30s and 40s, out in the desert, constructed by young apprentices that were learning by doing. That was Wright's great motto, learning plumbing, learning electrical work by actually installing it. You know, some of these systems are now at the end of their life expectancy.
Prozillo says renovations will stay true to history, except for one of Wright's key styles.
You know, he used this place as a laboratory, and it was ever-changing. And he asked his apprentices, well, I think we should change this. Let's take down that wall. We don't continue that tradition of change and removing things. We're now in a position where we're trying to keep Taliesin West for future generations.
Half an hour from Taliesin West is a historic resort the foundation calls one of the world's best examples of a luxury hotel strongly influenced by Frank Lloyd Wright. The Arizona Biltmore was designed by one of Wright's students. For these Biltmore blocks, Wright was an on-site consultant, and he designed the stained glass mural. Public relations director Sarah Moran says another reminder of Wright's influence is the Aztec Room.
You can see the beautiful Biltmore block all the way around, the gold leaf ceiling and the copper beams. We've really tried to keep this room looking like it did back then.
Moran says that any beautiful historic building becomes a time capsule, and that makes it worth preserving. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Phoenix, Arizona.
A robotic mission to the moon has intentionally crashed into the lunar surface. Before the program crashed, scientists collected data from the craft called LADEE, an acronym for Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports on some preliminary findings.
1-0 ignition and liftoff.
LADEE had been orbiting the moon since October. The tube-shaped probe is about the size of a vending machine with solar panels mounted on its sides. Its mission was to study dust in the lunar atmosphere. Speaking by Skype from NASA's Ames Research Center, project manager Butler Hine says LADEE began taking measurements at 250 kilometers above the lunar surface.
And as we got lower into the science orbit, the dust density just kept increasing.
So where does all that dust come from? And how does it move about the moon? Flying at an altitude of between 20 and 50 kilometers, LADEE's array of instruments took some 700,000 measurements to answer those questions.
And one of the things that that we saw is that it's almost a continuous shroud around the moon. And some of the production of the dust is done by meteoroid impacts to the moon. And that's kind of a continuous rain on the moon. And so the source of the dust is kind of a continuous thing.
Hine says while a moon-based observatory would have to account for the dust in its optical design, dust would not pose a problem for a spacecraft or human activity on the surface.
And what we've seen so far is that while there's a lot of dust, the levels are high. We haven't seen any indication that level of dust is a hazard at all. We haven't seen any degradation of our spacecraft systems, for instance, and the dust levels that we do detect wouldn't pose a significant risk to any future mission.
LADEE discovered traces of argon, methane, carbon dioxide, and other substances. It also successfully tested a broadband communication system between Earth and the moon. Hine says LADEE's new modular space bus design could be replicated on a range of missions.
The spacecraft can be put together in different ways depending on the type of mission. So for instance, this bus can be configured as a lunar orbiter, which is what LADEE is. It's designed for the environment anywhere between the Earth orbit and Mars orbit. It's even designed as a lunar lander configuration. So you can take some of the bus modules, put them together in a fashion where it could land on the moon.
Among the tense moments for Mission Control in California was a lunar eclipse during Laddie's final days, which put the solar array in darkness. For 4 hours, the craft had to depend on its battery to protect its systems from freezing.
We basically prepared the spacecraft ahead of the eclipse, where we turned off the science instruments to conserve power. We turned on and off different heaters, or configured them to go on and off. And then we let it fly through the eclipse. The challenge was, we're not getting any power generated, and we're drawing a lot more power during the eclipse to keep things warm.
But Laddie did not need much more power. The craft was programmed to self-destruct on the far side of the moon, away from the historic sites where astronauts had landed. It continued to gather and send data in its last days as it flew just 2 kilometers above the lunar surface, en route to the planned crash. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Many parents of children with disabilities fear for the future of their adult child. It can be difficult for them to find work or live on their own. Oftentimes, help comes from the community of families affected by the same condition. The mother of an autistic boy set up a foundation to advocate for the estimated 1.2 million American adults with autism, a developmental disorder that causes communication difficulties and often social awkwardness. Faiza Al-Masri has more in this report, narrated by Faith Lapidus.
Rafael Angevine can spend hours taking photographs.
I just do it for myself. I don't try to set up a scene or anything. I just take pictures.
Rafael was diagnosed with autism 3 years ago when he was 26. His father and mother, Noeli, encouraged their son to pursue his passion for photography.
His photographs, the way he sees the found object, the ordinary object, and picks up what's beautiful about man-made things as well as what's in nature, to me, is almost mystical.
When Raphael's therapist told Noeli about an art exhibit by autistic artists, she wanted her son to participate. The exhibit, called Through Our Eyes, is sponsored by the Madison House Autism Foundation, a nonprofit that advocates for autistic adults. Co-founder Jalen Price named it after her 24-year-old autistic son, Madison.
The most daunting concern is, when I'm not around any longer, who is going to make certain that my son has a happy and productive life?
The foundation lobbies for legislation to enhance opportunities and reduce barriers to meeting the housing and employment needs of adults with autism.
Employment is huge because it's estimated about 85% of those on the spectrum may never have totally gainful employment.
Sponsoring the exhibit advances another goal of the foundation: promoting understanding and inclusion in the community.
We don't have enough physicians that know anything about adults on the spectrum to be able to treat these adults. We have safety issues in the community. Some of our population tend to wander. And what happens if they encounter a police officer and a police officer asks somebody to stop? And they're not going to stop because they don't know the police officer. And it can escalate before someone even understands that someone may be on the spectrum. They may feel that they're on drugs or something else.
The art exhibit includes the work of more than 20 artists and is presented in collaboration with the universities at Shady Grove in Maryland. The school's executive director, Stuart Edelstein, says it is a great learning opportunity for his students.
We are in the process of educating students who will become nurses, teachers, social workers, and general citizens in our community. And for them to understand in a more deep way the needs of a segment of our community, people with autism, is really important in terms of their professional development.
Noeli Angevine, Raphael's mother, agrees that events like this benefit people like her son and society at large.
The economy would profit by using the talents of people like Raphael instead of letting them end up on the street.
It gives her hope that her son will continue to have a good life when she's no longer around. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
That's all the time we have for this week's program. Our thanks to executive producer Bob Doty. If you'd like to hear more about these stories, check our website at voanews.com. And we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at americancafe@voanews.com. For all of the folks here at VOA, I'm Ira Melman. We'll see you next time on American Cafe.